through this window from these windows to the past, we shall behold the majesty of the mighty ocean of the covenant. Let the sound of the awesome waves bring to mind how it has and shall continue to surge, cleansing itself from all impurities. Its force, irresistible, its stronghold, well guarded, and its reality, the all-encompassing revelation of Baha'u'llah, destined to bring about the kingdom of God on earth. Let these admonishing words of Abdu'l-Bahá ring throughout this talk, as they are assuring to the faithful and foreboding to the insincere. Hope. These agitations of the violators are no more than the foam on the ocean, which is one of its inseparable features. But the ocean of the covenant shall surge and shall cast ashore the bodies of the dead, for it cannot retain them. End quote. This very unique and unprecedented feature of the Baha'i faith will be discussed in four parts: the covenant of the Bab, the covenant of Baha'u'llah, the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, and finally, covenant breaking. The inspiration and foundation for preparing this talk was the beautiful work of Mr. Adib Taherzadeh called The Covenant of Baha'u'llah. The other nine references are the Kitab-e Aqdas, Tablets of Baha'u'llah, Baha'i World Faith, Selected Writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, Abdu'l-Bahá by the Hand of the Called H.M. Galuzzi, God Passes by Shoghi Effendi, Shoghi Effendi's Messages to the Baha'i World, The Priceless Pearl by Amatu'l-Bahá Ruhiyye Khanum, and Memoirs of 9 Years in Akka by the Herald of the Covenant, Dr. Yunus Khane Afroukhte. What is the meaning of covenant? The dictionary describes it as an agreement between persons or parties. Usually there are at least two parties involved in agreeing upon the terms of the contract. By listening to the following analogy by Mr. Taherzadeh, one easily can get a deeper understanding. As soon as a child enters into a school, he or she enters into a covenant with the principal. The principal draws up a program, assigns the teachers, and provides the facilities. All the child has to do is to attend the classes and do the assignments. The terms of such an agreement are drawn by the principal alone, with the students having no say in it. The principal is wise, knowledgeable, and strong. The same is true in the covenant of God and His messengers with people. Going one step further, we can easily see that a child must attain certain degree of maturity before such cooperation could be expected of him. It is not practical or fair to impose such an agreement upon an infant or a toddler. In this dispensation, mankind has matured enough to comprehend the significance of such covenant and see how himself is the beneficiary. That is why in none of the religions of the past such a well-defined covenant was ever established. It is one of the unique features of the Baha'i faith for a maturing humanity. In this presentation, two covenants will be discussed. One is the covenant of all prophets or manifestations of God with people regarding the appearance of the next manifestation. In this category, only the covenant of the Bab will be discussed. The second covenant is the unprecedented covenant of Baha'u'llah for the accomplishment of the following. 1. Protection of the revealed word from human interference. 2. Preservation of the integrity of the faith. 3. Purity of its teachings, principles, and laws. And 4. Safeguarding the unity of the Baha'i community, which is an absolute requirement to bring about unity of mankind. These will guarantee the spiritualization of the human race and development of needed agencies for establishment of the Baha'i World Commonwealth to usher in the Kingdom of God on earth. In the second category, the covenant of Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha will be discussed.
Part 1. The Covenant of the Bab. The Bab was not just a forerunner to Baha'u'llah. He was an independent manifestation of God. He abrogated the laws of Islam. No one except a manifestation of God has the authority to abrogate the laws of a former dispensation. His ministry, though only 6 years, served the purpose of paving the way for the coming of Baha'u'llah. His laws were contingent on Baha'u'llah's acceptance. The most significant part of his writings were devoted to establishing a covenant with his followers concerning the revelation of Baha'u'llah, whom he referred to as Him whom God shall make manifest, or Man Yozhero Hollah. He mentioned that term more than 300 times in the Persian Bayan, and more than 70 times in the Arabic Bayan. These two books are the mother book of the Babi dispensation. In several instances, he identifies Him whom God shall make manifest with the designation of Baha'u'llah. As you recall, at the Conference of Badasht in 1848, Baha'u'llah assumed the title of Baha for himself. Prior to that, the name Baha'u'llah had already been revealed in the Persian Bayan. The following is a passage from the Persian Bayan. Quote, "Well is it with him who fixeth his gaze upon the order of Baha'u'llah and rendereth thanks unto his Lord." End quote. Both the Bab and Baha'u'llah were natives of Persia, now known as Iran. They never physically met. The Bab was 2 years younger than Baha'u'llah and declared his independent religion in 1844. 6 years later, he was martyred by a firing squad of 750 soldiers after the first firing failed. The Bab's unique mission in the history of religions is that he stood between two religious cycles. With his appearance, the prophetic cycle ended. This cycle began with Adam as the first manifestation of God in the recorded history and ended with Muhammad, the founder of Islam. That is why Muhammad was designated as the seal of the prophets. At the same time, the Bab inaugurated the cycle of fulfillment, whose duration, according to Baha'i writings, will be at least 5,000 centuries, as compared to 60 centuries of the Adamic cycle. The Bab repeatedly gave the year 9 as the date of the appearance of Baha'u'llah. In the Islamic calendar, the year of the declaration of the Bab was 1260, and it was 1269 when Baha'u'llah received his intimation in the Siya Chal of Tehran. This was in October of 1852. The Bab also made reference to the number 19 for the revelation of Baha'u'llah. 19 years after the declaration of the Bab in 1844 brings us to 1863, when in Baghdad, Baha'u'llah declared himself. The Bab clearly told his followers that his own revelation was entirely dependent upon him whom God shall make manifest, and that he was only a servant at his threshold. His utter humility towards Baha'u'llah and craving to be martyred in his path is manifest in his writings. In one example, the Bab states, quote, "Of all the tributes I have paid to him who is to come after me, the greatest is this, my written confession, that no words of mine can adequately describe him, nor can any reference to him in my book, the Bayan, do justice to his cause." End quote. The Bab testifies in the Bayan that the greatest proof of Baha'u'llah is the revelation of his words, and that should anyone claim this station falsely, he will not be able to sustain it. Nevertheless, in order to prevent anyone from mistakenly opposing Baha'u'llah, the Bab warned his followers not to oppose anyone who might claim that station. As history witnessed, after the martyrdom of the Bab, 25 followers of the Bab claimed to be him whom God shall make manifest. 2 noteworthy among them were Nabil, the great historian, and Dayan, the prominent Babi from Azerbaijan. However, nearly all of them, after meeting Baha'u'llah, realized their delusion and repented. The Bab clearly stated that Baha'u'llah lived among them, and how they should adorn themselves with good character, dress clean and tidy, and avoid argument and contention to avoid offending Baha'u'llah. Also, the Babis were to leave a vacant chair in their meetings, a seat of honor for Baha'u'llah. He further mentioned that him whom God shall make manifest would also leave a seat of honor vacant in his own home, and that Baha'u'llah would be inwardly amused by those who venerate his name while remaining veiled as to his identity. The followers were to arise whenever they heard the words, "Him whom God shall make manifest." You should realize that Baha'u'llah was known as Mirza Hossein Ali, or Janabe Baha, until his declaration in Baghdad. No manifestation of God has ever made a covenant with his followers regarding the next manifestation to such a degree as to regard himself as the lowliest servant at his threshold, and to recognize him as the source of his own revelation, desiring to lay down his life in his path.
Well, you may think that it should go smoothly because the Bab's ministry was so short and the advent of Baha'u'llah so near. Not to mention the clarity of the Bab's prophecies, such as the year 9 and 19, and also the name Baha'u'llah stated in the Bab's writings, and the following statement, quote, "When the day star of Baha will shine resplendent above the horizon of eternity, it is incumbent upon you to present yourself before his throne," end quote. We recall that 2 years before the martyrdom of the Bab, at the conference of Badasht, Mirza Hossein Ali assumed the name of Baha. But somehow the followers did not put these two Bahas together. The Bab never contemplated the appointment of a successor for himself. In the Bayan, he confirms this by saying that in his dispensation, there was to be no mention of successorship. Yet, as we shall see later, Mirza Yahya broke the covenant of the Bab and claimed to be his successor. Before mentioning who Mirza Yahya was and the course of events, let us digress to another part of the history. The fame of Baha'u'llah as a dynamic, noble personality promoting the faith of the Bab was spread far and wide, which put his life in danger. For example, after the conference of Badasht, while Baha'u'llah was visiting the poor town of Bandar-e-Gaz, the order of the king arrived for his immediate arrest and transfer to Tehran, the capital, for execution. Later the same day, the news of the king's death arrived, so the order was not carried. You must realize that Baha'u'llah was aware of his own station from childhood. In one of his tablets, he describes that when he was very young, he was overcome by a condition which completely affected his manners, his thoughts, and his words. A transformation occurred, and the ocean of utterance began to surge within him, and this condition, Baha'u'llah testifies, continued throughout his life. During the Bab's ministry, three of his followers, who were all the letters of the living, recognized the station of Baha'u'llah. These were Mullah Hussein, Quddus, and Tahireh. Then comes the inspiring story of Sheikh Hassani Zanuzi, which, in the interest of time, will be mentioned briefly. Sheikh Hassan followed the Bab during his captivity. At the fortress of Chehrir, the Bab instructed Sheikh Hassan, who was advanced in age, to go to Karbala, a holy city in Iraq. He promised him that he would attain the presence of the promised Hussein. This is an Islamic term for Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah visited Karbala in 1851, 1 year after the martyrdom of the Bab and a year before his imprisonment in the Siyah Chal. Baha'u'llah at the courtyard of the Islamic shrine approached Sheikh Hassan and intimated his station to Sheikh Hassan. Sheikh was so overwhelmed that he wanted to proclaim his discovery publicly, but Baha'u'llah told him to keep it secret. Now listen to this. This was a year before Baha'u'llah received his mission in the infested Siyah Chal. He told Sheikh Hassan, "The hour has not struck yet," and how he would declare it in Baghdad, which, as we know, took place 11 years later. It really staggers one's imagination. As Abdu'l-Bahá has explained, a manifestation of God is always a manifestation of God, and all the powers are latent within him. He likens it to a man who is asleep until the hour strikes for the birth of his mission. Other than those believers, the followers of the Bab in general were unaware of the station of Baha'u'llah. It is easy in retrospect to say why. Even those who witnessed the humility and reverence of Quddus and Tahireh at Badash and Mullah Hussein at Fort Sheikh Tabarsi towards Baha'u'llah were veiled. It surprised them greatly to see that much reverence and humility shown to Baha'u'llah. Perhaps being of the class of nobility and not the ecclesiastic was the veil.
Now Mirza Yahya enters the scene, the unknown who was made known, but through his own doing was eventually lost in the valley of ignominy. As was mentioned earlier, Baha'u'llah's fame put his life in danger. So to divert the public, Baha'u'llah, through a trusted emissary, advised the Bab to nominate Mirza Yahya as the leader of the Babi community. You recall that the last 4 years of the Bab's life were spent in captivity. At that time, Mirza Yahya was in his late teens. This enabled Baha'u'llah to direct the affairs of the Babi community behind the scenes. The community was not informed of the reason for such an appointment, and possibly came as a surprise to many. A little background information on Mirza Yahya helps. He was a paternal half-brother of Baha'u'llah, and about 13 or 14 years younger than Baha'u'llah. When their father died, he was only 8 years old and grew up under the care of Baha'u'llah. When the Bab declared his mission in 1844, Mirza Yahya was 13 years old. As we know, Baha'u'llah soon accepted the faith of the Bab. He helped this young brother to recognize the Bab, embrace his cause, and to read the Bab's writings. To educate him better, Baha'u'llah assigned him to transcribe the writings of the Bab, which at that time was the only way to make additional copies. Consequently, not only Mirza Yahya learned the style of the Bab's composition, but also learned how to imitate the Bab's handwriting. When he rebelled against Baha'u'llah, this helped him to forge the Bab's writings with his interpolation of the words in his own favor. Now that you have the picture, we can go to the Babi community after the martyrdom of the Bab. The followers suffered terrible persecutions. Their hope for triumph was dashed as the outstanding followers were mowed down. Baha'u'llah, the only leader who inspired confidence, was instructed by the government to go to Karbala, which he did for almost a year. Soon after his return, he was cast into the notorious Siachal of Tehran. The totally dispirited community did not know where to turn for guidance, since Baha'u'llah, after his release from the Siachal, was exiled to Baghdad in Iraq. The only leader they were told to turn to was Mirza Yahya, who spent most of this time in hiding, roaming the countryside in disguise. Mirza Yahya's title from the Bab was Sobh-e Ezel, meaning morning of eternity. Therefore, later, his few followers were called Ezelis. When Baha'u'llah was exiled to Baghdad, Mirza Yahya lost his guide and protector. He went into disguise to a western city, one of the stopping places where Baha'u'llah stayed on the way to his exile in Baghdad. Baha'u'llah's faithful brother, Mirza Musa, called on Mirza Yahya, now about 18 years old, and advised him to visit Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah extended his guidance and protection and responded to his request to live in Baghdad in seclusion near Baha'u'llah's residence. Baha'u'llah gave him some money. Disguised as an Arab, he made his way to Baghdad soon after Baha'u'llah's arrival there. He stayed a few days as the guest of Baha'u'llah, and not wanting to be recognized by Persians, secured a residence in the Arab quarters. He threatened to excommunicate whoever insisted on visiting him or revealing his identity. While they were in Persia, Baha'u'llah used to dictate directives to the Babi community, which Mirza Yahya signed and sent under his name. But he had great ambition to bypass Baha'u'llah and to assert himself one day as the successor to the Bab. However, it is a known fact that whenever he came face to face with Baha'u'llah, he could not utter a word. The breaking of the Bab's covenant by Mirza Yahya and his mentor brought great test for the Babi community and a severe crisis which was repeated a few times by other rebels in the course of the history of the faith. However, in this dispensation, each and every time the ocean of the covenant surged powerfully and expelled the debris. What a mighty and undefilable ocean! Mirza Yahya, though ambitious, did not have the courage to oppose Baha'u'llah. He was shallow, timid, and jealous. As a master of disguise, at one time he pretended to be a Jew, and another time an Arab. In the garb of a dervish, he was so well disguised that when he appeared in Baghdad, at the door of Baha'u'llah's house, their brother, Mirza Musa, opening the door, failed to recognize him.
He needed a catalyst or mentor which was not too far away. Sayyid Muhammad Isfahani, the embodiment of evil and known as the Antichrist of the Baha'i revelation, found it the opportune time to step in. He was a Muslim theological student in Isfahan, Iran, but was expelled for his reprehensible conduct. In the early years of the ministry of the Bab, he became a Babi and moved to the holy city of Karbala in Iraq. For the first time, he saw Baha'u'llah in 1851, 1 year before Baha'u'llah's imprisonment in the Siyachah. The majesty of Baha'u'llah as a Babi nobleman sparked the fire of envy in him. 2 years later, when Baha'u'llah was exiled to Baghdad, his rising prestige and popularity intensified the fire of jealousy. His satanic influence complemented Mirza Yahya's weakness and ambition. The two of them spread the seeds of dissension among the followers in Iraq and, through their letter-writing campaign, confused the Babis in Iran. The whole reason for Baha'u'llah's seclusion for 2 years in Soleimaniye was their divisive activities. Just one example will give you an idea. Towards the end of Baha'u'llah's stay in Baghdad, they wrote that the Book of Certitude, or the Kitab-e-Iqan, was written by Mirza Yahya, but Baha'u'llah published it under his own name. When Baha'u'llah was exiled to Istanbul, he took Sayyid Muhammad with him to keep an eye on him, but Mirza Yahya refused to go with him, fearing extradition to Iran or being murdered. His wives were under the protection of Baha'u'llah and were in his caravan. At midpoint, Mirza Yahya joined the caravan, but insisted that his identity should not be unveiled. This was not hard to do, since not many people had met him, as he was always in hiding. And those who had met him well recognized his shallowness. During 4 months in Istanbul, the government had appointed a man to look after Baha'u'llah and his companions. Mirza Yahya told the man that he was one of the servants in the household, and to prove it, at times would sleep in the servants' quarters. After their exile to Adrianople, he and his evil comrade felt that the danger was over and began their open opposition. The desperate Mirza Yahya, in the first year of their stay, invited Baha'u'llah to his house and had smeared a deadly poison on the lip of the teacup. Miraculously, Baha'u'llah survived that, but was left with the shaking hands. With his sin-covering eyes, he kept the matter confidential, but Mirza Yahya spread the word that it was Baha'u'llah who wished to poison him. Therefore, the followers learned the cause of Baha'u'llah's serious illness, which lasted a month. At one time, he poisoned the family's water well, and another time he asked their mutual barber, a devoted believer, to cut Baha'u'llah's throat with a straight-edge razor. When this news was spread by the barber against the advice of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'llah wrote the Surah Amr, Amr means command, in his own handwriting, declaring his station to be the one promised by the Bab. Do you think Mirza Yahya, the appointed leader of the Babis whose term should have terminated with the coming of the promised one, backed off? To your surprise, the following day Mirza Yahya dared to send a message to Baha'u'llah that he himself had become the recipient of divine revelation. Now the two rebels began their letter-writing campaign to the followers and the government officials. When Mirza Yahya's complaint that Baha'u'llah was not sharing the government's allowance with him and how he and his children were starving was brought to Baha'u'llah's attention by a friendly governor, the most great separation occurred. Baha'u'llah moved with his family to another house and told his brother, Mirza Musa, to divide everything in half and give one half to Mirza Yahya. Baha'u'llah secluded himself for 2 months to give a chance to the followers to decide between him and Mirza Yahya. This had electrifying effect on the followers in Iran, 99% of whom rejected Mirza Yahya. The time of the most great separation was when the terms Baha'i and Azali began, the latter meaning followers of Mirza Yahya. The tragic downfall of Mirza Yahya came through a plot masterminded by the evil Sayyid Muhammad. The scheme appeared to be a surefire for them. It was to hold a public confrontation between Baha'u'llah and Mirza Yahya. You might think it was a stupid idea, because a quivering sparrow was no match for the falcon. But Sayyid Muhammad was sure that Baha'u'llah would not accept it, since he usually did not seek public appearance. Well, Baha'u'llah accepted the challenge, and on the appointed day and time he walked among the curious crowd who were informed about it. Upon reaching the mosque, he was told that due to unforeseen circumstances, Mirza Yahya wished to postpone it. This time, Baha'u'llah fixed the time and place, but there was no reply from the two. In 1868, when Baha'u'llah was exiled to Acre, Mirza Yahya was exiled to the island of Cyprus. That island was known to the ancient Turks as the Isle of Satan. 11 of 18 apostles of Mirza Yahya, called witnesses, turned in repentance to Baha'u'llah. Mirza Yahya's eldest son, his nephew and niece, repented to Abdu'l-Bahá and became dedicated believers. Baha'u'llah, in spite of all that Mirza Yahya did to him, through his mercy in the Kitab-e-Aqdas, offered forgiveness should Mirza Yahya repent, but he chose to die as a covenant breaker. He died in Cyprus in 1912. After witnessing the triumph of two covenants, that of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, he and his mentor were nothing but a foam on the mighty ocean of the covenant, leaving no trace.
Part 2. The Covenant of Baha'u'llah. There could be no more befitting introduction to this part other than Baha'u'llah's own words, forecasting the greatest crisis in the history of the faith. Quote, "My sorrow is not for myself, but for him who shall come after me in the shadow of my cause, with manifest and undoubted sovereignty, inasmuch as they will not welcome his appearance, will repudiate his signs, will dispute his sovereignty, will contend with him, and will betray his cause." End quote. One should not question that with his foreknowledge, why did he not prevent it? Friends, this was the test of fire to separate the faithful from the faithless. This was the choice for the followers and a crushing force necessary to solidify the foundation of his mighty covenant, free of debris. Due to lack of maturity of mankind, none of the religions of the past left a clear document for the followers, appointing an authorized successor to the Prophet himself. In this dispensation, as Baha'u'llah foretold, it is the day which shall not be followed by night. The Bab states that the day in every religion is when the founder is alive, reflecting the pure light of truth. After his passing comes the night, when only luminaries will shine. However, in the Baha'i faith, through the unparalleled covenant of Baha'u'llah, there shall be no night. Presently, the infallible universal house of justice, the offspring of this covenant, is guided by Baha'u'llah in leading the whole humanity to its glorious destiny. The utterances revealed by each manifestation could be likened to life-giving rain. After the passing of the prophets, the reservoir of teachings was made available to all. Such were the Gospels and the Quran. The Quran, revealed by Muhammad within 23 years, contains 6,000 verses. The downpour of Baha'u'llah's revelation came at the rate of 1,000 verses within 1 hour. 40 years of the ministry of Baha'u'llah did not produce a reservoir, but the name ocean could possibly do it justice. In the past, the reservoir was left open for free use by all without an authorized successor to protect its purity. With various man-made interpretations, the water lost its purity, resulting in sects and divisions. However, each sect thrived and grew on its own version of interpretation. Unlike that, Baha'u'llah provided a guard or wall surrounding the ocean of his revelation. This is called the covenant, the center of which is Abdu'l-Baha, his eldest son, and appointed by him as the authorized interpreter of his words. The institution of the guardianship and the universal house of justice, which succeeded Abdu'l-Baha, are the offspring of the covenant, and not its center, as has been sometimes mentioned in some publications. There is only one center of the covenant, and that is Abdu'l-Bahá. However, it must be well understood that they are all links of the same chain of the covenant. And, today, submission to the Universal House of Justice is the same as submission to Baha'u'llah himself. Another important point is that Abdu'l-Bahá and Shoghi Effendi's words do not have the same rank as Baha'u'llah's words, but have the same validity. Both were appointed, authorized, and infallible interpreters of the holy words. Only through Abdu'l-Bahá, the followers receive the unadulterated water of the revelation. Those who try to bypass him, undermine him, or his successors, withered and died, a continuous cleansing process. To discuss the affairs of the faith after the passing of Baha'u'llah, we need to become familiar with the family of Baha'u'llah, who survived him and played a role.
Baha'u'llah's faithful children were the oldest son, Abdu'l-Bahá, whose given name was Abbas, with many exalted titles from Baha'u'llah. His 2 years younger full sister was the greatest holy leaf, whose given name was Fatima, but was known as Bahiyye Khanum. Three half-brothers of Abdu'l-Bahá were Muhammad Ali, Ziaullah, Badi'ullah, and their sister Samadiyye, who married her cousin Majduddin, the son of Baha'u'llah's faithful brother Mirza Musa. Now we focus on Abdu'l-Bahá and his 9 years younger half-brother Muhammad Ali. Nearly all of these names have Mirza as prefix meaning Mr., but for ease to the ears of the Western audience, only names will be mentioned. Abdu'l-Bahá was highly spiritual, humble, and detached. At the time when Baha'u'llah was released from the Siyahchal in Tehran, Abdu'l-Bahá then, almost 9 years old, intuitively noticed the change in his father. When after their arrival in Baghdad, Baha'u'llah revealed his station to him, he threw himself on the feet of Baha'u'llah, begging to be accepted as a sacrifice. In the early years in Baghdad, when barely a teenager, Baha'u'llah conferred the title of master upon him and reserved it exclusively for him. Anytime someone referred to another son, such as Muhammad Ali, as the master, Baha'u'llah immediately would correct them by saying, "There is only one master. The rest have their names." During those years in Baghdad, when a learned man asked for Baha'u'llah's commentary on an Islami verse, he gave the assignment to his young son Abdu'l-Bahá. What Abdu'l-Bahá wrote evoked the admiration of the recipient and others. To some, raising a learned son like Abdu'l-Bahá capable of such writing was one of the proofs of the truth of the mission of Baha'u'llah. In contrast was Muhammad Ali. Witnessing the exalted qualities of Abdu'l-Bahá, he and his mother harbored envy and jealousy. Baha'u'llah conferred upon Muhammad Ali the power of utterance, and he excelled in calligraphy. He later misused both talents against Abdu'l-Bahá. During Baha'u'lláh's 5-year stay in Adrianople, Muhammad Ali put a number of Arabic verses together and disseminated them among the Persian believers. This young man in his early teens introduced his verses as the verses of God and claimed that he was a partner with Baha'u'lláh in divine revelation and that he was the sovereign ruler of all who are in heaven and on earth. Such boldness and preposterous claim evoked the wrath of Baha'u'lláh, who rebuked him in strong words and chastised him with his own hand. Later on, during Akka years, when a book containing selected writings of Baha'u'lláh was going to be printed in India, Baha'u'lláh sent Muhammad Ali to write it in his good penmanship for reproduction. He interpolated and altered any part which alluded to the exalted station of Abdu'l-Bahá. Baha'u'lláh wrote the following specifically about Muhammad Ali. Quote, "He verily is but one of my servants. Should he for a moment pass out from under the shadow of the cause, he surely shall be brought to naught." End quote. And in another passage, he affirmed, quote, "By God the True One, were we for a single instant to withhold from him the outpourings of our cause, he would wither and would fall upon the dust." End quote. In total contrast to that arrogance and pride was Abdu'l-Bahá's self-effacement. During the Akka years, many letters from the celebrated Warqa were left unanswered by Abdu'l-Bahá. Warqa, who later was martyred, had the bounty of being informed by Baha'u'lláh about the station of Abdu'l-Bahá. When no reply was received from Abdu'l-Bahá, Warqa wrote to Baha'u'lláh, who instructed Abdu'l-Bahá to answer Warqa. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote a short answer stating, "While the pen of the Most High is moving upon the tablets, how could Abdu'l-Bahá be expected to write?" The relationship of Abdu'l-Bahá with Baha'u'lláh was very different from that of the other sons. He never entered Baha'u'lláh's room without permission. To Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'lláh was his lord, but to the other sons, he was a holy man whose influence accorded them great respect and many privileges. When Baha'u'lláh moved to the mansion of Bahá'í, although Abdu'l-Bahá was the one who had secured it, he did not move with the family, but stayed behind in Akka. Knowing the envy of the half-brothers and their mother, he did not wish to become the cause of dissension. He, with his mother, sister, the greatest holy leaf, and his family stayed in Akka. To visit his father, sometime he rode a donkey. As soon as the mansion came to sight, he would dismount and walk the rest of the way. A servant would never ride up to the presence of his lord. He often prostrated at the feet of Baha'u'lláh, and more than anyone else was the recipient of admiration and bounties of Baha'u'lláh. At times, when at the mansion, Baha'u'lláh missed Abdu'l-Bahá and would write in his own handwriting for him to come for a visit. In servitude and humility, no one has ever surpassed Abdu'l-Bahá. Although the recipient of glowing titles from Baha'u'lláh, he was totally empty of self and ego, capable of receiving the revelation of Baha'u'lláh flowing from the summit of his glory.
As we get closer to the ascension of Baha'u'llah, two other individuals enter the scene. One was Mirza Aga John, Baha'u'llah's secretary for 40 years, and the other, Majduddin, Baha'u'llah's nephew and son-in-law. Before sharing some information on these two, you like to know that according to the following passage of the Kitab-e-Aqdas revealed in 1873, 19 years before his ascension, there was no doubt that there would be a successor who would be a son of Baha'u'llah. A son of Baha'u'llah was referred to as Ghos, meaning branch, the plural of which is Agsan. The quotation is, quote, "When the ocean of my presence hath ebbed, and the book of my revelation is ended, turn your faces toward him whom God hath purposed, who hath branched from this ancient root." End quote. Mirza Aga John, who was a soap maker, which was the lowly job for the uneducated, at age 16 as a Babi youth, attained the presence of Baha'u'llah 10 years before his declaration. Baha'u'llah revealed to him a glimpse of his glory. Baha'u'llah conferred such knowledge and ability upon him that made him capable of being his secretary, servant, and companion during 40 years of his ministry. His knowledge of rich Arabic and Persian words uttered by Baha'u'llah and his speed writing were extraordinary. It is known that of all the followers of Baha'u'llah, he was the closest to him. All communications to Baha'u'llah, gifts and contributions were channeled through him. Both Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha transcended above material wealth. However, Mirza Aga John, by asking Baha'u'llah to have some of the precious gifts, amassed wealth and with the help of Baha'u'llah's three younger sons, acquired some properties. In the last year of Baha'u'llah's life, Mirza Aga John displeased Baha'u'llah, who towards the end dispensed with his services and dismissed him. At times, Mirza Aga John's behavior caused Abdul Baha to rebuke him and even chastise him. As was said earlier, Abdul Baha resided in Acre, but during Baha'u'llah's last illness, he stayed in the mansion. Towards the end, he attended Baha'u'llah day and night, depressed about the approach of the hour. Baha'u'llah's papers, tablets, and seals were in the room. There were two cases in the room. Baha'u'llah used to place these materials in them whenever going away from the mansion. One day, he told Abdul Baha to gather everything and place them in the two cases. This broke his heart, since it intimated the nearness of the dreaded hour. He became so distraught that he hesitated to do the task when Baha'u'llah ordered him for the second time. Disabled by the mental anguish, he was slowly moving when his cousin, Majduddin, came into the room. With his assistance, everything was placed in the two cases. When finished, Baha'u'llah told Abdul Baha, in front of Majduddin, that from now on these two cases belonged to Abdul Baha. As we see later, Majduddin became the notorious brain behind Muhammad Ali and a formidable enemy of Abdul Baha. Review of details of history is way beyond the scope of this talk. However, it indicates that very probably, the alliance of the devious individuals fomented towards the end of Baha'u'llah's earthly life, if not earlier. From the text of the Kitab-e-Aqdas, there was no doubt in anyone's mind that the branch mentioned meant no one else but Abdul Baha. The thought of this sent chills through the spines of the faithless, who yearned for leadership and wealth at any cost. Back to the two precious cases given to Abdul Baha. Abdul Baha left the cases in Baha'u'llah's room, and in a short time on May 29, 1892, in the early hours of morning, Baha'u'llah ascended. Before sunrise, Abdul Baha asked Muhammad Ali to assist him in preparation of the body for burial. Muhammad Ali suggested that since in the process of washing,
The cases might get wet and ruin the contents. They better be moved out of the room. Abdu'l-Bahá consented. With the help of his cousin and brother-in-law, Majduddin, Muhammad Ali moved the cases to the room of Badi'ullah, Baha'u'llah's youngest son. As for their approximate ages at this time, of the three sons, Abdu'l-Bahá was 48, Muhammad Ali 40, and Badi'ullah 25. Majduddin, the evil cousin, in his late 30s, and Baha'u'llah's disgraced secretary, about 55. You can see that Muhammad Ali and cousin Majduddin were very close in age as well as treachery. Without doubt, as playmates when children, they planned usual childish pranks, but this plotting against Abdu'l-Bahá was a dangerous game. Although the two caused great suffering for Abdu'l-Bahá, for themselves it ended in spiritual suicide. Watch and see the crushing force of the covenant for those who oppose it. The sacred remains were laid to rest the same day. Abdu'l-Bahá states that on the fourth night after the ascension, so badly grief-stricken he could not fall asleep, around midnight he decided to walk a few steps in his room. Through the window he saw that the brothers had opened the cases and were looking through the contents. This added to his sorrow, but he thought to himself that since he was in possession of Baha'u'llah's will, it did not matter. How badly they wanted to put their hands on the will and alter its contents, as Muhammad Ali had done before to the holy writings.
9 days after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, his will was opened. It was called by himself the Kitab-e-Ahdi, meaning the Book of My Covenant, but referred to as the Kitab-e-Ahd, or the Book of the Covenant. In the morning, in the presence of 9 witnesses, including Muhammad Ali, the contents were read by a believer, and in the afternoon at the shrine of Baha'u'llah, Majduddin read it in presence of all members of the family and the believers in Akka and vicinity. The following paragraph, which supplemented Baha'u'llah's injunction in the Kitab-e-Aqdas, clearly appointed Abdu'l-Bahá as the successor and the authorized interpreter of Baha'u'llah's revelation. Quote, "The will of divine testator is this. It is incumbent upon the Aqsan," meaning male descendants of Baha'u'llah, "and Afnan," meaning relatives of the Bab, "and my kindred to turn one and all their faces towards the Most Mighty Branch," a title of Abdu'l-Bahá. "Consider that which we have revealed in our Most Holy Book. When the ocean of my presence hath ebbed and the Book of my Revelation is ended, turn your faces towards him whom God hath purposed, who hath branched from this ancient root." The object of this sacred verse is none, except the Most Mighty Branch. Thus, we graciously revealed unto you our potent will, and I am verily the gracious, the all-powerful. Verily, God hath ordained the station of the greater branch, meaning Muhammad Ali, to be beneath that of the Most Mighty Branch. End quote. No one raised any argument about the intent as well as the authenticity of the will, which was in Baha'u'llah's handwriting. Being so clear, how could anyone challenge it? Well, no one did. But the treacherous allies attacked Abdu'l-Bahá, trying to discredit and disqualify him. A few days later, a believer who had been honored with a tablet from Baha'u'llah asked Abdu'l-Bahá if he could honor him by affixing a seal of Baha'u'llah on that tablet. When Abdu'l-Bahá told the brothers to bring the seals, which were in those 2 cases, they denied any knowledge of existence of the cases. Abdu'l-Bahá states how his whole being began to tremble, and he knew that great tests and trials were ahead. Gradually, the whole family of Baha'u'llah who resided in the mansion went to the side of treacherous Muhammad Ali. When Abdu'l-Bahá, with his sin-covering eyes, ignored their clandestine activities and assured Muhammad Ali that he was the next in line for successorship, he boldly protested that there was no guarantee that he would outlive Abdu'l-Bahá. He arrogantly asserted that he was determined to usurp the position of Abdu'l-Bahá exactly the way Umar usurped the position from Ali, the true successor to the Prophet Muhammad.
For 4 years, Abdu'l-Bahá patiently concealed their seditious activities. Then, after their positions were fortified by egotistical followers and bribed officials, Muhammad Ali openly, through correspondence, announced his position. His false accusations against Abdu'l-Bahá were intended to discredit and disqualify Abdu'l-Bahá in the eyes of the believers as well as the officials. He did not contest the will, but opposed the appointee in the vain hope of replacing him. Interestingly, a believer wrote to him that even if the impossible death of the phoenix occurs, no one will become the subservient to the owl. Owl in the East is considered the bird of darkness, which is a bad omen. Abdu'l-Bahá was left with no choice but to expel Muhammad Ali and his allies as covenant breakers, and denounced him as the arch-breaker of the covenant, a stigma that smeared the pages of the history. From now on, at times, we may refer to him as the arch-breaker. The arrogant Majd-ed-Din, that formidable enemy of Abdu'l-Bahá, and the mastermind behind Muhammad Ali, was denounced by Abdu'l-Bahá as the incarnation of Satan. Abdu'l-Bahá once told him that he would live a long life to witness the triumph of the covenant and total frustration of his own schemes, and at that time he would yearn for the balm of death, but he will be denied. It exactly happened. He lived to be 100 years old. Miserable with paralysis and loss of speech, he witnessed the ministry of Shoghi Effendi and the rise of the Baha'i administration. His wretched life ended in 1955, 2 years after the launching of the 10-year World Crusade by Shoghi Effendi, the grandson of Abdu'l-Bahá, appointed by him as the guardian of the faith. You should also learn about the ending of the Archbreaker before a brief account of their outrageous intrigues cause you dismay. Muhammad Ali did not fare any better than Majd-ed-Din. He died miserably in 1937, outliving Abdu'l-Bahá by 16 years. Before his death, through the efforts of the guardian, he was removed from the mansion of Bahá'í, which due to neglect was in ruins. He also was stricken with paralysis, laid bedridden in pain before he died. He was buried according to Muslim rites. His grave remains without a tombstone. Now a summary of some of the events after the passing of Baha'u'llah. Soon after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the covenant breakers decided to put Mirza Aga Jan to death under the pretext of his disrespect to Baha'u'llah, but his wealth was needed to fund their schemes. He took refuge in Abdu'l-Bahá's house in Akka. Then he was coaxed to return because they could use him for another purpose. On the 5th anniversary of the ascension, he announced his affiliation with the Archbreaker and became a powerful tool in their hands. He pretended to receive revelations and wrote them in the manner he had written for 40 years. During a scuffle, many of his so-called tablets addressed to the believers in Iran fell on the ground. They were retrieved by a believer and were given to Abdu'l-Bahá, who displayed them. At the end of his life, before his death in 1901, he resided in the shrine of Baha'u'llah, which caused Abdu'l-Bahá not to enter it. At times, when Abdu'l-Bahá and the followers were praying outside, Mirza Agha Jahn would come out and in vulgar language swear at them. Zia-ul-Lah, the younger brother of Muhammad Ali, took the side of the archbreaker, but he was vacillating. He died in 1898 before he could do much harm, and after his death, Abdu'l-Bahá forgave him. Badi-ul-Lah, the youngest brother of the archbreaker and the youngest son of Baha'u'llah, who was 25 years old when Baha'u'llah ascended, though as treacherous as the rest, rendered a service which must be mentioned. Due to the machinations of the covenant breakers in 1901, by the order of the Sultan, Abdu'l-Bahá was confined again within the walls of the city of Akka. A couple years after that, Badi'ullah, then in his mid-30s, began to attend the gatherings of the Friends in the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá. When he repented to Abdu'l-Bahá, he was told that his repentance would be accepted when he would write a testimony to all of the treachery committed by his commander, his deputy, and himself. He left such a testimony revealing all their deeds, from the fate of the two cases stolen by the archbreaker to the alteration of Baha'u'llah's writing to make it appear to condemn Abdu'l-Bahá. It revealed their techniques of discrediting Abdu'l-Bahá and giving expensive bribes to the officials. Abdu'l-Bahá knew what was in Badi'ullah's heart. Therefore, one day he told the believers that everyone must write down what he had to say. Badi'ullah was present. Abdu'l-Bahá said, "Should he die, the house of justice should form and everyone must obey it." By this, Badi'ullah's hopes for successorship were dashed, and he went back to his old comrades. He lived a long life and caused great harm. He died in 1950, having witnessed 30 years of the growth of the faith under the ministry of Shoghi Effendi.
To discredit Abdu'l-Bahá, they had different scenarios for the Baha'is and the officials. Baha'is were told that Abdu'l-Bahá, against the injunction of Baha'u'llah, claimed to be a manifestation of God. Their letters to the Persian believers was that their cause was to purify the faith. This scenario was the justification for the attempt on his life. Twice the jug of his drinking water was poisoned. Once a covenant breaker carried a dagger, and another time in Haifa, before his second reincarceration, in the middle of the night, when returning home after seeing the pilgrims, three shots were fired at him, but none hit him. Another time, they falsified that Abdu'l-Bahá had claimed to be partner with God, so they called themselves Muwahhidin, meaning monotheists, and the followers of Abdu'l-Bahá, Mushrikeen, meaning polytheists. Muhammad Ali would send his children dressed in rags to the influentials of Akka pretending starvation due to Abdu'l-Bahá withholding their shares of the funds. Once it backfired because the receipt of his cashing a large sum credited to him by Abdu'l-Bahá came to open. Actually, they indicted Abdu'l-Bahá with a number of complaints. The first item shows their understanding of the station of Baha'u'llah. It stated that their father was a holy mystic man who lived mostly in seclusion and meditation, and that for political advantage, Abdu'l-Bahá had claimed that Baha'u'llah was the supreme manifestation of God. Other complaints were that Abdu'l-Bahá deprived them of inheritance and funds coming from the believers. Abdu'l-Bahá appeared in the court with Baha'u'llah's will in his hand. It answered every false accusation and the case was dismissed. Their expensive bribing was costly. They exhausted the wealth of Mirza Aghajan. Then, for their deadly strike, they sold 1/3 of the mansion of Bahji, and Majduddin took the bribe to the governor of the province of Syria, which included Akka, with a demand for the deportation of Abdu'l-Bahá. After a short digression, you will learn about the preposterous basis for his demand. You should study Abdu'l-Bahá's history to learn how these disbelievers in God and Baha'u'llah tried to block the purchase of needed land for the shrine of the Bab. For many years, until they were cast out, Abdu'l-Bahá supported them financially while they lived in luxury at the mansion, yet pretended to be starving and demanded more money. They wished to bankrupt Abdu'l-Bahá. They wrote to the Persian believers that Abdu'l-Bahá's seal for Hubbullah receipts was stolen by his followers who were pocketing the proceeds. This lie was not effective and the flow of Hubbullah continued. In the early part of 1900, Abdu'l-Bahá began the foundation of the Shrine of the Bab. The purpose of the visit of Majduddin to the governor was to alarm the government with false accusations that Abdu'l-Bahá, with the help of foreign advisors, was building a fortress on Mount Carmel. Now you will see how this plan also backfired and they were caught in their own web. In August of 1901, when Abdu'l-Bahá returned from celebrating a holy day at the shrine of Baha'u'llah, he learned that his half-brothers and Majduddin were taken away from the mansion of Bahji in the countryside to be confined to Akka. And Abdu'l-Bahá was also given the Sultan's edict for reconfinement within the city walls. You cannot believe that Abdu'l-Bahá, the exemplar of the teachings of Baha'u'llah, interceded on behalf of the covenant breakers who were released and returned to the mansion. The construction of the Shrine of the Bab was not interrupted by Abdu'l-Bahá's reincarceration. This lasted about 7 years. The greatest thing Abdu'l-Bahá missed during those years was not being able to visit the shrine of Baha'u'llah. Though the friendly governor of Akka advised Abdu'l-Bahá to feel free to go, he would not, preferring to obey the government. Twice the governor asked Abdu'l-Bahá to accompany him to visit the shrine, which Abdu'l-Bahá accepted. The second time, the governor had arranged for other dignitaries to accompany him. Near the shrine, they all, as a sign of respect, walked a few steps behind Abdu'l-Bahá. You can see how the covenant breakers were aggravated by watching this procession through the windows of the mansion. Throughout those years, Abdu'l-Bahá communicated with the believers by writing as many as 90 tablets a day. The first section of his will and testament was written during those years when his life appeared to be in danger. In this will, he appointed his grandson, Shoghi Effendi, then a child, as the guardian of the cause of God.
In 1904, another document of accusations about Abdu'l-Bahá's activities was sent by the covenant breakers, which brought the Commission of Inquiry to Akka. Abdu'l-Bahá visited them several times. With his explanations, the case was dismissed. With the political situation in the capital rapidly becoming unstable and the Sultan becoming fearful, the covenant breakers took advantage of it and sent a new petition accusing Abdu'l-Bahá of condemning Omar and Sunni Islam, as well as preparing to take over the government. A new hostile commission of inquiry was dispatched to Accra in 1907. They dismissed the friendly governor, closed the telegraph office except for their own use, and established direct contact with Muhammad Ali, the archbreaker. Spies were posted everywhere, and Abdu'l-Bahá's house was under constant surveillance. While they received lavish hospitality from the covenant breakers, Abdu'l-Bahá ignored them. He was busy repairing his house, planting trees, and storing fuel for the winter, which surprised many inhabitants who believed that without doubt his days were numbered. With the rumors widespread, they believed that he would be either executed or exiled to a desert in North Africa. As the events were moving to a climax, with the jubilation of the covenant breakers, something special happened. A friendly Italian man who had the agency of a shipping company visited Abdu'l-Bahá in the middle of the night and offered a specially dispatched ship at his service to take him to any port in the world. Abdu'l-Bahá invited some of the elders of the Baha'i community to consult on it. They unanimously agreed that he should accept the offer. Abdu'l-Bahá looked at them disapprovingly and stated that running away had never been the practice of the chosen ones of God. The commission did its final inspection of the shrine on Mount Carmel, and its strong walls and the vault in it left no doubt in their minds about its purpose as a fortress. The four members of the commission boarded the ship, which left Haifa, to cross the bay towards Accra. As the sun was setting, its lights were quite visible to many believers who, with their hearts in their throats, were monitoring its movements. To them, and everyone else, that was the end. Soon they would be taking their beloved master away. What a disaster! All of a sudden, the ship changed its course and headed for the open waters of the Mediterranean Sea. That day, a bomb intended for the Sultan had exploded in front of his royal coach, which killed a few, but he was not harmed. With the gravity of the situation, everything else was put aside, including the commission's report. Soon the revolutionaries demanded the release of all political and religious prisoners. In the summer of 1908, Abdu'l-Bahá was freed, and a few months later, Sultan Abdul-Hamid was deposed. Abdu'l-Bahá stated that the hand of Providence removed the chains from his neck and placed it on the neck of the Sultan. Now a few words about the activities of the covenant breakers in the East and the West. It suffices to say that the archbreakers' chief lieutenants were the greatest teachers, who got quite egotistical from their success. They had the promise of Muhammad Ali to be appointed as the head of the faith in those regions. After Muhammad Ali was cast out by Abdu'l-Bahá, 99% of the steadfast community of Persia rejected these expelled, arrogant teachers. In the United States, it took great efforts by Abdu'l-Bahá and teachers such as Mirza Abul-Fazl to clear the confusion created by the egotistical defector Ibrahim Khairullah, who had been a very successful teacher. The purpose of Abdu'l-Bahá's extensive travel to the West in 1912 was twofold. One was to proclaim the cause of his father firsthand, and the second was to show the believers in the world that the foundation of the covenant was so firm it could not be harmed by the covenant breakers during his long absence from the Holy Land.
Part 3, The Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, The Administrative Order, the Offspring of the Covenant. This vital document, the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, called the Charter of the Administrative Order by Shoghi Effendi, was unsealed at a crucial time when the Ark of the Covenant appeared to be heading toward the treacherous waters of rebellion and division after the ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá. The twin strongholds or mighty pillars of the administrative order, namely the institution of the guardianship and of the Universal House of Justice, were the offspring of the two monumental charters, the Kitab-e Aqdas and the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá. Before that critical time, it was the period of smooth sailing with Abdu'l-Bahá at the helm. The defeated creatures of the dark were hiding in their dens, wondering what went wrong with their plans. They mourned Abdu'l-Bahá's survival of the onslaught of their successive assaults. Their dismay had no bounds when, towards the end of World War I, Jamal Pasha, the commander of the Turkish army, could not crucify Abdu'l-Bahá as he had promised, having been conquered by the British army. Then, after the war, Abdu'l-Bahá was knighted in Haifa by the British government official, General Allenby, for his humanitarian services rendered during the gloomy days of the war. Shoghi Effendi, Abdu'l-Bahá's eldest grandson, received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Beirut in 1918 and was more than glad to return to his grandfather, whom he loved so much. For 2 years, he acted as Abdu'l-Bahá's secretary for his English correspondence. How unforgettable were those two happy years in the life of Shoghi Effendi, who would accompany Abdu'l-Bahá when meeting dignitaries and officials. Abdu'l-Bahá had made an allusion about a possible trip to India and the Far East, the United States and Europe, taking 4 to 5 years. It is possible that Shoghi Effendi was counting on accompanying him on that trip. After all, when he was 15 years old, he accompanied Abdu'l-Bahá on the start of the trip to the United States, but through the mischief of a jealous relative, Shoghi Effendi was forced to return to Haifa from the port of Naples, Italy.